This new signal is the fourth of seven. It appeared over the Klingon planet of Boreth.
Whatever it is you're not telling us about Boreth, I need to know.
These signals have invested in Discovery, but you must not dismiss the importance in defeating Control.
That's a Section 31 ship.
They are all Section 31 ships.
They're coming for us.
The signal brought us here for a reason.
The future hasn't been written yet.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, getting my hands on some raw time crystal.
And we have a very special guest, soaring in on a D7, Barry Link.
Hey, a classic D7, too.
That's right.
I dig. So, Barry, I think you are the 27th guest on our show that's a journalist, so I'd like to thank you for joining us on this program. Cam, what's the deal with journalists and Star Trek fans?
I don't know. That's an excellent question, because it seems like there are a lot, at least in the Vancouver area.
Yeah, so it's amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, and of course, Tyler, for you and I, this is kind of like a reunion.
Yeah, you used to produce all of our podcasts at work. I used to guest on the podcast that you did, and so it's kind of, is it weird for you to see me on this side of the boards, like I'm the one like pushing all the dials now?
It's kind of like seeing your children go off and grow up, and they've gone to college, and now they're in charge.
And they still don't impress you.
I just thought you'd be bitter. It was like, how come this guy wasn't working the boards back in the day that I was there? So, okay. But Barry, look, new guest, first-time guest on the show. I think we want to get a little bit of background until we dive into this latest episode. Cam, remind me what the title is. Something about shadows.
Through the Valley of Shadows.
Through the Valley of Shadows. Very deep, very,
very ominous sounding. Yeah.
But Barry, tell me, what was your introduction to Star Trek, the franchise as a whole?
I go right back to the original series. I watched it when I was a kid, and probably this would be like the late 60s, I think, is sort of my earliest memories.
Oh, right.
I'd have been like 3 or 4,
wow.
I think. And when I first saw it, I didn't realize that these guys were in the future.
Oh.
You remember some of the classic episodes where they time traveled back to the 20th century?
Sure, a piece of the action.
Exactly. I think those were some of the first episodes that I saw. So as like a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, I thought, okay, this is 20th century and they have some kind of secret ship that they fly around
right.
in.
This seems like some Assignment Earth action.
I was going to say, yeah.
Did you want to like pull yourself up a rocket ship, much like Batman and Robin would, very much as displayed in that episode?
With a cat on your back?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. Is there like a standout episode from the original series that's, I don't know, your mind is always drawn to at this point?
I think...
50 years later.
Yeah, from the original series, I think my favorite episode, and I don't know the title of it, is the first time they come across the Romulans. And if I remember back in the original series, they've never seen the Romulans in person, or they've never seen images of them. They had a war before, but it was all the negotiations for the peace treaty were done remotely. And it's the very first time they see them, and it's this, I can't remember exactly how they come into conflict with a Romulan ship, but they have this kind of cat and mouse game that they play. And it's very much like, I think that the metaphor they're using is like a World War II destroyer and sub battle where... they each have sort of certain advantages and certain technologies, and they have this, you know, really cool sort of tactical one-upmanship that's going on.
Cam, might that be your favorite episode from the original series? It's up there for you, I know.
Balance of Terror is in my top probably 5.
Yeah.
I think I always kind of come down on with Doomsday Machine.
Okay.
Just because it's Kirk at his most badass.
Yeah. So. Talking down computers.
Very
fun.
Shallow pleasures for me.
Well, you're on the right show.
Yeah.
So, Barry, what is your favorite series? Is it the original series or is it one of the other from the milieu of Star Trek shows that are out there?
Yeah, no, TNG would be my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
The original series I'll always have strong affection for, especially when you see those episodes when you're young. They feel iconic.
Right.
They kind of, everything else kind of sort of pales in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the TNG is my favorite because it's the show that really rescued Star Trek, because we had the original series and they had that first terrible movie.
Hey.
And then a couple of, which I think has actually aged fairly well.
I really like the motion picture, but I totally understand why most people don't.
Well, when it first came out, people were like, yeah, what? And then The Wrath of Khan came along and we're like, yeah, okay, that's what we want. But a couple movies, but I don't think there was really clear direction for where the show was going to go or where the franchise was going to go. And I think TNG kind of set the course. It certainly did set the model for, you know, several series after that, the look, the feel. And of course, you know, it had Picard,
right,
who is one of my favorite captains. He's probably the captain I'd like to serve under if I had to choose between all the Star Trek captains.
I think almost everyone would say that.
We had
even ones who don't name
podcast.
TNG as their favorite. I think they would still be like, you know what? I probably want to be on Picard's ship.
Yeah. I'm more of a Jellicoe guy, you know,
obviously,
Chanuk fan.
But
for you, Barry, I mean, were you watching it right out of the gate in like 1987, or did you come around in, say, the syndication era for TNG?
I watched it right out of the gate, as you said.
That fascinates me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. It was every Saturday night in Victoria. I would get together with friends. We'd have pizza and we'd watch TNG. And so I was able to watch all of the episodes, you know, as they unspooled.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the first two seasons were really kind of trying. They were painful.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so even people who have not seen it the first time around, at least you'll recognize that.
And they
were still finding their feet. I think in the first season, they were trying to still do classic Star Trek, and they weren't doing that well. Second season, they started to kind of generate it. And then, of course, the third season, when they had the whole Picard story with the Borg, that's when it really started to come into its own. I think that's when they finally understood how the characters work and how they work together.
So what are you thinking of Star Trek Discovery at this point? Because Star Trek's been off TV for quite a period of time before it premiered. Where are you at right now with this particular series? Is there a particular episode that maybe stands out to you, or what are your overall thoughts?
It's been a kind of a love-hate relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Star Trek. I have to watch it. I'm going to watch it. Doesn't matter what they do, I'm going to watch it, because I've watched just about everything. I think I've missed some of the Voyager episodes here and there, and I think probably most people have missed some of the Voyager episodes here and there.
We're not most people, Barry.
No, I've seen everyone.
That's why you do the podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't remember all of them, though.
Yeah.
The Neelix episode.
Yeah.
I mean, before the show, we were talking about how, you know, this show has broken canon, and you said, well, every Star Trek show has broken canon, and you're right. I think this one has some of the most dramatic departures from it, particularly with the Klingons.
Certainly visually.
Visually, yeah.
I do wonder, and we had this debate last week, Cam, is whether Discovery means to be like a bridge sort of series, like trying to connecting the gaps between the visual styles that we saw in Star Trek Enterprise versus TOS, and who knows how that unfolds from there. But to me, it is like a visual reboot. I can wrap my head around that. I'm not too hung up on it. When I hear lines like Pike says he hates holographic communications, rip it all out of the ship, that kind of makes me cringe. Like, I don't need to hear him say that sort of stuff. It kind of takes me out of the moment. Personally,
I think that's just for the fans, basically, and for some of the grumpy people. I mean, there's a lot of things I don't like. I don't like the mushroom drive. I don't like the holographic communication and the Klingons. I don't think they knew exactly what they were trying to do with them.
Yeah, especially in season one. Like, I think we're getting to a point where they feel more like Klingons. But season one, I could admire that they were trying something different, but it did not feel like Klingons.
Yeah, it felt like, I don't know, some kind of part Klingon, part X, something else.
Yeah.
But I think you and I came to the conclusion that the whole reason that they went in this direction, Cam, is because they wanted to have that Ash Tyler twist. They wanted to have like an unrecognizable actor beneath all this latex so that they could reveal that this human character was the same as this quote-unquote Klingon. So was it worth the twist, this big visual reboots? That's still up for debate. I think you and I are a bit more fans of where they're going with the Klingons, although this is really just the second time we've seen them all season long. So,
but I am curious, Barry, like, how do you kind of compare season one of Discovery to season two far? Like, do you feel like the show's been getting more to your liking, or does it still feel a little confused? Or
yeah, no, I think more to my liking. I think that, you know, for writers, particularly when they work as a group on a show and you have a showrunner directing them, it takes a while for them to figure out where the characters are going to go and where the stories are going to go. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that the first season had a lot of trouble with it, was going in different directions, different people involved, and I think it showed. But they can do whatever they want. I mean, they can do mushroom drives, and they can do they can fool around with the Klingons, and I'll accept that. I don't want to hem them in. I think that that's would be dampening creativity, and the show should go in many different directions as it always has. But at least, you know, I like the fact that they brought back Pike. I love the fact that when they first introduced Pike, they have the approximation of the original uniforms from the original series. That was a nice sort of, they've done a lot of touches like that, that are throwing back to the, to the origin of Star Trek. And of course, when they did that episode a few weeks back on Talos IV,
if memory serves.
Yes. Especially when they began it with what was it last time on Star Trek,
and that was amazing.
That's a Discovery high point at this. You know, that's among the top five greatest moments on this series so far.
That was, I think, my favorite so far of the show.
Nice.
Because they recognized the heritage, and they didn't try to hide it. They didn't try to change it. Mm-hmm. But now they're also building on it.
Right.
So they can go in many different directions. I allow them that freedom, but they recognize where they're coming from. And I think for most Star Trek fans, that would work.
So for an episode like this, I was a little worried going in. I was like, is this going to be another one of those connective tissue sorts of episodes that, Cam, you and I have been kind of lamenting, the ones that seem to be more like place setters, setting things up? For whatever reason, this one actually kind of works for me. And I should go beyond that, more than just kind of works for me. I think this is still the show getting what it means to be a serialized program, making sure that the serialized stuff matters. I think we could look back at the previous episode, The Red Angel, and say, hey, there's actual emotional beats that we're hitting here within the serialized storytelling that work for us. This one, I keep thinking about, what is the emotional beat here that tightens everything up? I got to go to Pike. I think this moment here where he is on Boreth, which we know that his son is on, or that I should say that Ash
Pike's
Tyler's
son. Yeah. Oh my God. Plot twist.
There's so many.
Next week.
Yeah.
They've all got sons on Boreth.
But for me, I mean, there's so many kind of little hints about Boreth in like Star Trek's canon with regards to, we know that that's where Worf went, for instance, after the Enterprise D was destroyed. He spent an extended period there. We knew that his son, played by one Kenneth Mitchell in this episode as the Time Crystal Priest or monk. That was fascinating to us, Cam, because you and I debated whether or not that was, in fact, Kenneth Mitchell.
Kenneth Mitchell apparently is going to play every Klingon on the rest of Discovery.
I'm down for it. He's the new Vaughn Armstrong of Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, they want that Captain Marvel power. That movie just crossed $1 billion worldwide. They're like, we want Kenneth Mitchell now.
He's going to be the main marketing arm for this. Yeah. But from your perspective, Barry, you said earlier on, you've been loving Pike so far this season. What did you think of this, especially when they actually, and I never thought I'd ever see this realized on screen, but they actually showcase his radiation accident that put him in the wheelchair that we know so much from, say, the Menagerie in the original series, that two-parter there. What did you think of an episode, you know, really showcasing kind of the spine of Pike's, you know, existential journey as we know it going forward?
I was wondering when they were going to get around to that, mm-hmm. and when they were going to introduce it, and the kind of anticipation or even like a fear, because I really like the Pike character, is mm-hmm. when they would introduce the accident.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it depends how long they want him around, because once he has the accident, what's he going to do? Kind of like roll around in the ship and
I'm watching that spin off.
Yeah.
And exactly. Anson Mount has been so amazing on this season.
Yes.
You could see how they might want to milk it for as long as they could.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the ironies of this series that is trying to be, and I think succeeding in having an incredibly diverse cast, as Star Trek usually has tried to do, mm-hmm. But they still put a white guy in charge on the ship. He's not the main character, but for me, I think he's one of the most interesting characters, and one of several characters that I think when they're in the scene, the energy of the show picks up.
Big time.
I'm totally with you. Cam, what do you figure with regards to what we got to see this week with him unlifting the veil of time? Unlifting the veil of the present?
I mean, I think I let out like a yes when I saw wheelchair in the distance. I mean, we've often commented on, as we call them, Burnt Pike. And I like that they really played up the horror of it.
It was horrifying.
It was horrifying in a way that I don't know that the original series works as much now. Especially because at that point, viewers didn't really know Pike that well. Mm. Whereas we've now gone through this journey with Anson Mount Pike, and it seems everyone has fallen in love with him. And so now when you see this, and he looks like Mason Verger in Hannibal, I mean, he looked like they really amped up the horror of it in a way that I thought was very effective, because I don't know that that's necessarily an ultra accurate representation of what Pike is going to look like at that point, but it's more of kind of the horror of that, what he sees in himself, I think. Because it definitely looked like they were playing some little CG tricks with it there to make it more of a horror movie shot.
But, you know, when I saw the actual wheelchair, like, to me, that actually was like a pretty cool update about what we were used to seeing, or what we associated with the Menagerie as well.
He, so, he didn't use the ding-dong machine, as you call it, though.
Yeah, I know. I forgot the word bell. I'll never live this down, Cameron. But aside from the ding-dong machine, we've seen a wheelchaired version of Pike in three iterations of Star Trek. We've seen it in the Kelvinverse, we've seen it in the Menagerie, and we've now seen it in the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Does the Kelvinverse one count?
I think it was kind of like a nod to the canon, but so this is my question, though. How does this version stack up versus the other versions that we've seen, just with what we know is going to be the ultimate fate of Pike, which is not just necessarily a gentleman who's longed for this world, at least in like a physical capacity.
Sure.
Well, his ultimate fate, though, if they hold to the storyline, is that he's heading back to the planet with the nice lady.
Right.
And even though they both have physical deformities and in their physical cells have a lot of pain, the illusion that's built around them would be sufficient that I think you can say they're going to have a good end.
Yeah, and I think that's like a very insightful thing with regards to his ultimate fate is, and I love the line that he gives to the Klingon monk where he's just talking about how he believes in compassion, he believes in service and sacrifice. I'm not willing to give that up, not willing to give up who I really am at my core just to save my life. And I think if we know, Barry, as you point out, that he ultimately has a fulfilling destiny, one in which he's happy on this planet, at least in his own mind, if not his body, I think it gives us a little bit of solace as viewers that this is not just like a horrible, horrible fate for this particular guy.
I think it also makes his fate that much more powerful, because we always knew it was radiation burns from an accident. And we see the flashback to that moment, and I gotta say, it's not that impressive looking. However, we know that he does that in that moment, and you're like, wow, you know, good for him. But now we know that not only did he do that, he knew in advance that this was going to happen, and he still went through with it. That, to me, makes the tragedy of this character infinitely more profound. It's one thing to, you know, get injured, but it's another thing to know you're going to get injured and still accept that future.
So we're talking a lot about the subtext here. If I can just be the dumb viewer, like just looking at the stuff that's right there on screen, I do kind of like the shout out that they give a little bit to Wrath of Khan with him, you know, pressing up against the glass
There's a lot of glass pressing in this series.
Fair enough. You know, I do think we get a Wrath of Khan reference about every other episode.
There was one last week. I think Burnham and her mom did it, too.
Makes sense to me. So. What do you think, though? Was this a bit of a shout-out to the Kelvinverse uniforms that the Admirals wear when we see Pike in that very, very distinct-looking uniform, one that we have not seen so far in Star Trek Discovery? Because we do know that this event takes place about 10 years down the road. Did that pop out to you guys? Because I think there's two very distinct costume changes that we got from notable characters. Any?
I only
thoughts?
Noticed the parka.
The pika?
The pike parka,
So his new uniform didn't really stand out or anything like that? Okay. I don't know, Barry, am I just like the one who's out there noticing costumes
more? You're all alone in this one. I just noticed the cheap parka, too, and I thought, the guy's not wearing any gloves.
No.
It's pretty cold.
What's with the black badge? Is he all of a sudden like with Section 31?
I noticed that. I couldn't figure that one out. Yeah.
I'm guessing they just gave it to him so he could have communications with the ship.
Like kind of the comm badge that Section 31 has that the rest of the fleet does not?
It's almost like it's the sort of thing that feels almost like a cutscene of like you have this as a backup, but we're not going to give you a communicator because he wants to go down with nothing on him. I don't know. Who knows?
Guys, my best laugh that I got out of this one, I think it was totally not meant to elicit a laugh, but remember when Saru said there's 30 ships, that's almost their entire fleet? I'm like, are there 31 ships in the fleet? Is that what they're trying to say? I was like, that's really on the nose, guys. Like that, I think that's what they're trying to do. That has to be a joke, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going like nuts.
I think so. Okay. I hope so.
Okay.
I really like, though, talking about Klingons and Pike being on this planet. I feel like a lot of times in the past, I've complained, like with Klingon planets, why would I ever want to go there? They look dirty. They look kind of, they don't look like sets that are like, that's really visually interesting to look at. And, you know, you look at what the Kelvinverse did with the Klingon planet.
Like, well, they were in a toxic wasteland and all. Sure. Like, they had nuclear fallout.
That's the only glimpse we saw of Kronos in the Kelvinverse. And it was not pleasant to look at. And they had a lot of money to work with. And so I really appreciated that this episode is actually making, you know, Klingon architecture and, like, the world of the Klingons visually dynamic. And so I actually want to see more of it. It gave it kind of that Lord of the Rings type feel, I suppose. But I actually think this show has done a really good job in making the Klingon world seem vibrant and interesting, whereas a lot of the time, when you look at, you know, the Burman era, it doesn't visually look that interesting.
It's very rainy whenever Worf had to go back and hang out with Chancellor Gowron, so I don't know.
Yeah, that and Ferenginar, it's always raining.
Yeah.
Whenever you go to these alien planets, it's always raining.
Yeah, but
like Vancouver.
Yeah, it's true, it's true.
It's those tax credits that keep coming back. But Barry, for you, what do you think so far? We've seen Kronos early on in the season. We've now seen Boreth. What do you think of how they've been showcasing the Klingon planets at this point? Is it a little bit more visually engaging? Do you think it's a little bland? What's your take?
Yeah, no, this one was better. And you're quite right. Like, Klingon depiction in the past, I think, has been based on characters and not on on the homeworlds. I mean, whenever they've gone to the homeworlds or planets, it's never been convincing because, you know, it's like I said, a toxic wasteland or it's on half on fire. Like, where do they grow their food? And
and they didn't have much money to work with, to be fair, either.
Yeah, so. But this was interesting. I mean, when Pike first enters the monastery, I sort of thought, had this Game of Thrones set feeling like, okay, maybe they borrowed some stuff from Game of Thrones, although it's wrong continent. I'm wondering maybe what university in Toronto they went into to get this kind of cathedral. I wonder if it's the U of T or something like that. But I did appreciate the fact that, yeah, there's some architecture, and we saw Klingons with the aid of time crystals growing plants, and, you know, like
I thought they were growing kryptonite. Stuff. Wasn't that kryptonite?
Oh, it could have been, yes.
I thought Pike was getting the kryptonite at the end. Ensign Mount is the ultimate Superman, am I right?
Time crystallite.
Yeah.
Okay, so jumping off the Klingon stuff, let's go back into kind of what would be the emotional core that they're getting at here. We have the return of Laurel, who, Cam, I think you and I both thought she was a real standout from season one.
Definitely.
This is really only the second time we've seen her, but let's get into the return of Laurel with the D7 cruisers, which I think we've all been itching for, because I have to admit, I don't want to be one of those nitpicky fans, although I guess that's all I
think
really
that's
do.
What you do every week on
Pretty
this
much,
podcast.
Yeah, but I wasn't a huge fan of the original designs of those Klingon ships that we saw in season one. I'm loving these classic designs. There's just this simplicity to it that I think ultimately works. And when I see that the Klingons are introduced this, you know, later on into the season, after kind of we had those holographic images of them early on in the season, I'm like, yes, we're getting back to kind of the Klingon canon. Where are you at right now, Barry, with regards to kind of the return of Laurel and this ongoing Klingon storyline that we're seeing here?
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on the return of the D7s. And again, that's another callback to, you know, to the foundations of Star Trek, because it's the Klingon ship, the D7, it's got that iconic look. And when you see that, you know, it kind of takes your breath away. Just in the same way in any of the shows, if they ever have any kind of a visual representation of the original Enterprise, your heart skips a beat in some way. So it's the same thing. Now, with her return, it gives Ash something to do. But, you know, again, before we recorded, you guys were saying that, what is this guy doing?
we say that every week on the podcast, to be fair.
He sits in rooms a lot.
Yeah, he sits in rooms, and then they call him out, and he says something, and they get mad at him, and then he defends himself, and they go, sorry. And and then he goes away, and he's done nothing. I thought that I was wondering if maybe they were going to send him away, and he'd be part of the spinoff series.
Yes, you know, based on I floated that theory as well on the podcast,
which I think would be great because you've got this kind of
motley off Discovery.
Crew. I don't mind him. I think the character's interesting. The actors is good, but yeah, they're not doing anything.
They're not giving him like a lot of great material. I think that's been the issue. Like, our issue hasn't been the actor or anything like that. And we loved Voke as a character. I thought Voke was like a standout, like very, very fascinating character. We only got him for like three episodes and then they dispatched him and turned him into Tyler. So we've always been like pining for, you know, Tyler to have some interesting stuff to do. I think they're going in that direction. I think they planted the seeds early on. Under no circumstances was I expecting for the adult version of this baby to return in season two. I mean, I think you and I debated.
Like, how many episodes ago was that? Like five?
Yeah, you six? And I were talking about like whether or not we'd ever see, I don't know, like a teenage baby, like, you know, by season three or something.
Played by Michael Dorn. You know,
yeah, that was just the joke because like the thing is like we saw how fast Alexander grew up. So we're like, okay, well, it makes sense that we could have Ash interacting with his son later on.
It's funny that this season of Discovery is all about time, and time on Discovery moves very quickly because I don't know if anyone remembers, but like Ash Tyler was stabbed in the guts like last episode.
They never acknowledged it, did
they? No, they did not.
Yeah, we were kind of bummed out that we never got to see, say, the debate that Culber would have to do, but whether he'd give him surgery or not.
And then we had like Laurel on this one being like, I've come to accept at this point that, you know, our love will never exist. It's like, I feel like that happened very quickly. Like, she came to this realization quite easily.
Klingons mature faster than humans do.
And she's like, I know you'll always be in love with Michael Burnham. And I'm like, really?
But if she's a true Klingon, she should be killing Michael.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. No, that's a good point. Who would win in a fight, though? We've literally seen Burnham, like, kill the previous, you know, king of the Klingons, as T'Kuvma called himself.
Yeah, but would she have in hand-to-hand combat?
But didn't she, like, shoot him in the chest with, like, a... Or... Because, remember, one Klingon was stabbed in the chest, and the other was, like, shot through the chest. No, sorry. Shenzhou Georgiou was shot in the chest.
Stabbed
in the chest. And then T'Kuvma was shot in the chest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hand-to-hand combat.
I'm thinking of the fight with Cole, though.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
I think Cole would have beat her.
Yeah.
So,
but he got cocky, though. That's the big problem.
And he had a cape. Who isn't cocky in a cape?
Yeah.
So look at you right now.
I know. That's why, I need my podcasting cape if I'm going to do a good episode, Cam.
Suits you.
Thank you.
The wizard's hat's a little weird, though.
you had to be there. It makes sense in context. So, the Tyler versus Laurel stuff, it's working for me in that we're getting more Laurel, which we always like. We're getting Tyler to actually have a little pathos here.
Yeah.
Them having to deal with the fact that, look, the whole reason they put their son on this planet was to protect him and the Empire. And look, if it comes back, you know, later on in season two, I don't want to have to wait until season four to have this.
Sure.
But did it take you by surprise at all, Barry, that, I mean, it's literally like an old man who is his son at this point?
It did. And their reaction seems surprisingly muted. Like, oh. Yeah. Really? Okay.
Oh, he had a nice name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good,
okay.
Good to know he turned out okay.
I mean, they've missed everything. They've missed not only his first steps, but like his college years and his first love or whatever else he might be doing in the monastery. Like, they've missed all of that. And they're like, yeah, okay.
Do you have a first love in the monastery?
If you look historically at monasteries, probably they do, but you never know.
Yeah.
It seemed to be a mixed gender
It did. Yeah,
monastery.
That's true, yeah.
So, yeah.
I have a question, though. So we know that time is really amped up in this temple. If he leaves and goes off planet, is he still that age, or does he revert back to a baby?
Like, does he walk out in his baby shoes?
Yeah, like, is time all kind of blended together in this temple because of all the crystals?
I think we need to ask Dr. Soren.
Well, that's a good point.
Because time is the fire in which we burn.
That is true.
I have to do fan fiction in my head right now, but I always kind of envisioned the son of Nun, as he was called, would grow up to be that Klingon that we saw in Blood Oath from Star Trek Deep Space Nine that featured Koloth, Kor, and Kang taking vengeance for whatever reason. And there's a lot of hints that could have been the case.
I never liked that theory. Like, I totally get why fans were on board with it and why it made sense, but to me that character was not at all interesting.
But I think it's interesting that you try to create such a non-character given this background. And look, you can actually understand why he'd be taking vengeance on these noble Klingons where he's like kind of the son of Nun, literally.
Right.
I don't know, but does that do him a disservice? Is this old Klingon even going to be able to realistically like make it another 140 years into the future?
Right.
I don't know at this point. But I don't know. These are just like these out there fan theories that have been floating out.
So what do you think of how time works in there? Is he that age if he leaves? If he beams onto Discovery, is he still, I don't know, whatever.
Is he a baby?
Like 50 years old, it looks like, or something like that.
Okay. Because, as you said, like it's all kind of dependent on them being surrounded by those time crystals, right?
Right.
Maybe he's only an adult while he's in that monastery. But could he, Barry, do you think he could hang around in that monastery for 50 years and walk out looking like, you know, Benjamin Button or something?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out because does the time crystal aging or time difference, does it happen to them incidentally, or do they manipulate it? And the show seemed to suggest that they manipulate it, especially when they were growing all those plants and things. So there's a couple of things, like, did anything happen to Pike just by being there, aside from the revelation he had about his future? But secondly, if they can if they experience time differently, and let's say from the normal universe's perspective, their aging is accelerated, can it also go backwards?
Right, yeah.
Because they go forward in time, and Star Trek, they also go back in time. Mm-hmm. So could he, if he wanted to head out and you know, recover some of his youthful vigor, could he just wipe 50 years off of his age, and then he's a 20-year-old guy, or however old he would be?
So right.
I ultimately think that he is gaining these experiences. And so if he leaves the temple and that's all wiped away, I think that takes a lot from his journey. And I think what the story that they're trying to tell us, though, is that you can't escape your fate. And I wonder if he can't escape his own fate, where no matter where he goes, he's ultimately going to be the gentleman that he has grown into at this point. So I think, yeah, he could walk out of the temple. He's like a, you know, 40-year-old guy, I guess, at this point.
Sure.
Sure, let's go with that. And he's not able to escape his fate. Now, maybe we can bring it back around to kind of some of the themes that we've been going on, that we've been seeing in this season, though. Pike is told, you cannot escape your fate. This right. is your ultimate fate if you choose this pillar of the present, as they called it. But what do you think, Barry, of some of these themes that they're exploring, where there's a lot of stuff about, you know, faith versus science, you know, destiny, free will? Where are you at with regards to how they touched on it in this particular episode, especially with regards to, say, this Son of None and the Pike stuff that's been going on here?
Well, with regards to Pike, one of the thoughts I had was, okay, he grabbed the one crystal and it reveals this horrible future. And of course, he doesn't know ultimately that, as far as we know, his ultimate fate will be, I think, happy or satisfying. But he's going to go through this horrible experience. And as you pointed out, he chose.
Right.
He knows that it's going to be horrible, extremely horrifying, but he said, I'm still going to do it. But my first thought was, you know, if that was me, I'd put the crystal down. I go, can I pick a different one here?
Is sure.
You know, like a more sort of benign future that I can go through and still save the universe. So.
Yeah. The green crystals are never good. If the Superman lore has taught me anything, you got to go with maybe the red one or something.
Yeah.
What is the red one?
It's only green.
I don't remember. It's like a little different odds, though.
Because they have like a yellow one and a red one and a green one.
I can't remember. I'm not as much of a DC guy, but I know that they have different things, and the green one's always the worst.
Okay.
So
So I'm also wondering with regards to Pike and us actually witnessing his fate here. Cam and I, we've speculated nonstop about the potential of a Pike spinoff because we have Anson Mount cast. We had them announce as if it was a huge deal that Rebecca Romijn would be playing number one. And
are you loving number one this season?
And her talk of habanero sauce. The
Sorry, you lost me.
Look on Barry's face is amazing because, like, if you think about what a big deal CBS made out of the announcement that Rebecca Romijn would be appearing as number one.
Yeah, the character made famous by Majel Barrett in the Cage.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And if you consider the amount of screen time she's had over the course of 12 episodes,
5 minutes or something.
About that. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe a little less. I don't know. So it's odd that they would make a big announcement about that. And they also made a huge deal about Ethan Peck coming here as Spock. So Cam and I have been thinking, like, they have to be setting up, like, a Pike spinoff, considering how great Anson Mount is just, like, portraying this character.
And fans are so on board with him at this point that
I know.
I think that they would actually have really good ratings, at least really good crossover ratings from Discovery to this other show.
But does it sap tension? And that's what I want to get at, Barry, here. Does it sap tension if we as a viewer, let's say we'd never seen the Menagerie or anything like that from the original series, but all we know is Discovery and the Pike that we know from Discovery. Well, we know his ultimate fate, though. Does it take away from the adventures he's going to have week to week in any potential spinoff, knowing that, you know what, he's not going to die on this planet or that planet, or the ship's not going to be destroyed? Because we also know that, I mean, the Enterprise survived, you know, well into the search for Spock at that point. What's your take on any potential Pike spinoff? Does it even interest you with regards to giving him his own series set on the 1701?
No, I really would not want him in his own series, because I think he works because he works with this group. Mm-hmm. He's almost like the adult in the room. We've got different
characters.
I've
never been in that situation in my life, unfortunately. So I don't know what you're... I can't relate, Barry.
Eventually you'll get there, Tyler, so just have patience.
Will I, Cam?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. Cam knows me well, so.
I mean, I think one of the reasons why he's so popular is because he's very grounded.
Right.
He's a guy of experience and warmth. Mm-hmm.
You're using all the words people don't use to describe me right now, Barry, but go on.
When we were doing the podcast before, people would say, who was that experienced warm guy that was a guest on your show last week? So don't, you know, cut yourself some slack there, Tyler.
That was Stephanie Ip.
That's true. Okay.
Good friend of the podcast, by the way. So, but you think that he works better in the kind of the setting that he is right now. And then if you put him in a different setting, give him his own show where he's carrying the burden, the magic is not necessarily going to translate then.
That's my feeling. I think they could do it. It just depends on the supporting cast that they bring with him and then the stories they're trying to tell. So I wouldn't tell him not to do it, but I just like him here because I think he really does. I think that he's one of the people that rescued the show this season.
Mm. I agree. Yeah, big time. He's really tied together season two in a really, really organized way. Whereas like season one felt like really jumbled a lot of the time. Season two has felt very consistent. We haven't loved every episode by any stretch, but with him there, it's given it a real consistency that I think could have been lost without him there.
But guys, if I ever thought that there was a chance of Pike coming back as captain of the Discovery for season three, I think that's pretty much been, you know, discarded by CBS. They've all out said that he's not coming back for season three, so it makes us think about what the next captain's going to be. And I think we got a very, very big hint during one very small scene in this episode. Cam, you have a look on your face? Do you know the scene
that
we're talking
about? I was just going to say regarding Anson Mount, maybe Anson Mount doesn't even want to do a spinoff series. Mm. Maybe we're being presumptuous and assuming like, no, he just desperately wants to do a Star Trek spinoff. Maybe he has no interest in it. Maybe he signed on to do one season and that's all he was interested in.
He's waiting on that Crossroads 2 money.
He's a very prolific TV actor. Maybe he's more interested in bouncing around and doing different things.
If I was Anson Mount, though, I'd want a steady paycheck knowing I'm doing a project that a lot of people would revere, though. And I think it makes sense for him and where he's at as his career. I mean, he's doing Hell on Wheels.
He was trying to do The Inhumans.
I don't know. I could buy that he would want to do a spinoff. And even if he's not going to be captain in season three, I could buy him coming back and doing many a guest appearance on Star Trek Discovery.
I hope so.
But guys, the moment that I'm getting at here is, do you recall when Burnham was talking to Saru in the corridor?
Yeah.
And she was giving out her plan to go take that shuttle over to Section 31 ship. And Saru signs off on it, and she was a little taken aback. She's like, I wouldn't expect that from you as acting captain. He's like, after I went through Vrahai, I'm a whole new captain now.
I think they're
really telegraphing that Saru's going to be in command of the ship by season three, though. That's just what I'm taking away. I think there were hints that maybe he was getting there by the end of season one. They went in a different direction. Barry, would you be averse to a Captain Saru? Do you think the character has earned it at this point? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I think he has, and I would like that. The character itself in season one, I had a lot of issues with, especially with the whole, you know, ooh, danger, fear, and things going off in his head, the little fiddly bits and stuff. I didn't like that. And, and the whole notion of a species bred to fear death, that's pretty a one-note kind of species.
I don't know. That's my species.
Well, for many of us, it is at certain points, yeah. But the way that they
developed
his character.
You've never flown on a plane with Cam, believe me. Okay. It's he's not joking.
My ganglia are just all over the place.
Yeah. So you're down with Saru. I think we had issues with him in season one as well, Cam, because I think he would like dip in and out throughout the season, and we kept asking ourselves, what's Saru up to? And I think by the time we got to the end of season one, we were like really digging him. We thought there was potential for him to be captain, despite the fact that there's been a captain waiting on Vulcan for the last year plus, I guess. But I'm down for a Captain Saru in season three. But Cam, do you think that they still want to change up kind of the dynamic moving forward?
Well, when I think about the first two seasons of Discovery, the captains have really given their seasons their energy. And it feels like a different energy than what the rest of the cast brings to the table. If you remove that and just have Saru as the captain, I'm like, is that two kind of been there, done that? Like, is that exciting when you look at the seasons that have come before where you had Jason Isaacs coming in as a captain and then you had Pike coming in? Like, does it feel, just in terms of publicizing your season and why fans should be excited, does that feel like a bit of a, okay.
I think what they're going to be doing, though, is publicizing Tig Notaro coming back as sure. series regular going forward.
For one episode. But I was going to say about Saru, like, I'm down in terms of, like, the character's journey. I think it makes sense to have Saru assuming captain role because we can't keep sidelining him for, like, seasons 3 and 4 of, like, you're the captain, but, oh, by the way, you're sharing it with someone else again. Like, we can't keep booting Saru out of the captain's chair time and time again. Unless they want to transfer him off the ship at the end of the season, like, you, yeah. I think, have to put him in the captain's chair.
It's kind of like that whole Will Riker dilemma, where sure. you keep yeah. asking yourself, why is Riker still serving aboard the Enterprise when, like, he's been getting, I think he was offered 2 or 3 commands during the 7 years of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Was the first one in season 3?
I think it may have actually been in season 1 or 2. I think that okay. was the USS Ares, if I recall correctly. I think that was season 2.
Okay.
And I think he got another offer at the end of season 3 with Best of Both Worlds.
Yeah.
And I think there may have been, like, another offer, like, towards...
I think, like, season 5 like or something. 6 or,
yeah. So, and then you're like, okay, well, I'm sure once the movies start, he'll get his own ship. No, we've got, you know, like a... an aged Jonathan Frakes.
Flying through the briar patch with a joystick.
Yeah. Well, at least he wasn't looking young with that beardless face that he had after that bubble bath scene.
Sure.
Yeah. Which, Cam, you keep trying to reenact it. It's not working for you, man. I just... But I don't know. So, yeah, maybe Saru is going to be in a similar situation. Mm-hmm. And you kind of wonder, like... Does it seem as if he's just being a static character, though? But I wonder if that's why they introduced the Vorahai this season, where
sure.
he is going to be having a different dynamic as captain in season 3, potentially.
Wouldn't you love to see, like, a fleet-based season or something where you had Saru of a captain of another ship or something? I think that could be really cool.
It'd be interesting. They could redress the Shenzhou, but I don't know. Barry, you're about to say something.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, will he bring a new, different kind of energy if he's the captain? I think he will, because he's a whole new Saru.
That's true.
I mean, I love the actor who plays him. I think he plays him really well. He's just especially the physicality that he brings when he walks, when he swings his arms.
I mean, he's no like Kenneth that. Mitchell, but...
There's only one Kenneth Mitchell, yeah, apparently.
Yeah. Apparently there's 3.
Yeah. Probably more to come.
Yeah. I have to believe it.
But, you know, they are definitely developing his character. And you remember, he has shown flashes of anger, mm-hmm. And almost irrationality, like really kind of a hot character. And I think we might see more of that. You know, not like a negative force, but certainly a captain of action, and someone who is not going to suffer fools gladly.
Right.
I think he's always been that way. He's always felt himself intellectually superior. And, of course, you remember that one where he talks about, has no one bothered to learn these languages, you know, when they were talking different languages?
Yeah.
That was a pretty great moment.
Is that Obel for Charon, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a highly accomplished person, and he knows it.
Right.
And I think as a captain, he would let people know that as well. And that would bring, I think, a new energy. I'm sure that, you know, for season 3, if they send Pike on his own, and maybe Ash on his own and so forth, and some other characters, they'll bring in a whole set of new characters.
Sure.
I think in the terms of the fictional universe, he deserves it. And I think that the energy he brings, I think, would do it.
Yeah. Now, Tyler, you referenced Tig Notaro before I cut you off to make a joke or something like that. But
I'm used to it.
You know, this is a character that we have been scratching our heads about because she was introduced in the premiere Brother and then disappeared and then showed up for one episode and then disappeared for a long stretch. And now she's back acting like she's been there the whole time. What are we to make of this character? Have you found her confusing, Barry?
Yes, I have. When she first showed up, I was thinking, why is she here?
What is she
doing?
Yeah.
And I never have seen her as a character. I've seen her as, yeah, there's Tig Notaro.
Yeah.
You know, on the Enterprise, or not on Discovery.
I thought her dynamic, though, with Stamets in her second appearance, that was a lot of fun, though. It just seemed like her, there's actually somebody on the ship who's willing to push back against this curmudgeon here.
And then, of course, in this episode, she continues that role. I think maybe her character is developing. But maybe they'll give her more to do because, you know, she can kind of be like, you know, referring to the original series, kind of like a McCoy sort of character,
sure,
irascible.
Yeah.
But McCoy is in every episode. Like, she's just, like, popping in and out indiscriminately. It just seems so weird that she's supposedly supposed to have a prominent role. But I'm just baffled. She is a commander, right? But she's serving under the chief engineer, She was chief engineer aboard her previous ship. I don't know why she's still on Discovery. They've never actually explained why she is literally still on Discovery. Shouldn't she have been sent back into the fleet somewhere? Like, I'm very confused about... They haven't explained her presence at all.
HR is a little bit behind on this show, I think.
You know, after the Klingon War, they lost some records. It makes sense. Right. Yeah.
I mean, I like her so much on this show. If you tell me season 3 she's a regular...
The captain?
Yeah, the captain.
Sorry, Saru.
If you tell me she's a regular season 3, I'm happy. Like, I think this is a character that brings a lot. I do think it's notable, and I think we kind of got to talk about this, is that she played a very active role in this episode in helping to mend the wounds of the Culber and Stamets story.
Yeah.
And I think it was entertaining, but I wonder if it's taking away from Stamets and Culber, these two characters, if you have this really, really energetic outside character popping in to help smooth things over and kind of give it a little bit of momentum.
Does it feel a little sitcom-y to you?
A little bit, yeah. And Stamets is a character we've been really getting frustrated with in the last few episodes, just because he's such a great character, but it feels like they're just kind of writing him as kind of mopey. He's going full Ash Tyler in a lot of ways.
We don't really know what he's doing there, like what he's adding to the story necessarily. It seems as if his entire arc has been around, you know, his marriage.
Yeah.
It isn't a bad arc to have, but he seems detached from the rest of the series, which is a little odd.
Yes, and here he's like, well, I'm going back to my lab, and then we get her taking the more active role of actually not only, you know, helping communicate with Culber, but also being really entertaining, and the writers are giving a really interesting dialogue to do that with. Like, what has Stamets been given?
I know, it's kind of a tough go. I mean, for me, Barry, like, when season one started, for the first half of that season, Stamets was, like, my favorite character. I felt, this is, like, a character I've never really seen before in Star Trek. He pops...
You're only saying that because he was like you.
I know. Okay, Cam always says that he's exactly like me. But where are you at right now with the journey of Stamets, Barry?
I'm having the same frustration because he was so much fun. He was one of the few bright lights, I think, of season one. And
he was a point of light.
A point of light, exactly.
And Cam's favorite episode of season two.
Yeah.
And then it kind of went south when the show wasn't quite sure to do with the spore drive.
Yes.
Because, of course, it was so central to season one because it was their secret weapon, and it created all kinds of problems for him and situations his character had to face, and that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially one because he's a fun character but not a likable colleague. Kind of like, you know, the way I was describing Saru might be
sure.
when he finds his captaincy. In this, he's lost his mojo, and, of course, his partner died, so you can understand that. But you know, I have a lot of problems with how they brought that character back. I don't know.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're with me on that.
Yes.
Is that the most convoluted retcon of a death?
Yes. And I mean, I'm glad that they brought the character back. They shouldn't have killed him off in the first place because there was no point in
that. We agree.
Okay.
We agree.
Okay,
yeah.
So we're all on the same page here. The problem is that this guy's come back from the dead, but he's not really the character. He's from some kind of alternative universe, and no one thinks this is a big deal.
Yeah,
they're making it an issue of a relationship, which makes total sense. But you know, Section 31 would be locking this guy up because what is he?
Yeah, that's
a
good point.
Wouldn't Section 31 be locking up the Klingon double agent? But instead, they go ahead and recruit him. Like, I don't understand Section 31's policies at all.
Keep your enemies close, right?
Okay.
So
much
there's kind of
mirror universe deposed emperors. Like, gotta
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are the people you want working for Section 31.
And former Shenzo workers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Was anyone blown away by the return of Comron Gant? Who did anyone remember this person
I
at all?
I did not. They showed a flashback that was from that episode,
yeah,
right?
I wanted Daft Punk to be like the person like in that EV suit.
Literal
like,
Daft Punk.
Literal like Daft the, Punk. The, yeah, the Frenchman.
Yeah.
You know. But we got Comron Gant, and I was just like, huh?
That is officially the closest to my namesake for a Star Trek character.
For a character, I still think Planet Kaminar is where it's at.
If I get both, that's awesome.
I know.
So you've just broken all the Gant fans' hearts out there, Tyler.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. What do you call a Gant fan? A fant?
I guess so, a fant.
Okay. I do want to go backwards just a little bit with regards to the Culber Jet Reno scene, though. I think we shouldn't like brush past the fact that this is the first LGBTQ like one-on-one marriage counseling scene that Star Trek's ever done, and the way they handled it is very normalized, which I think that we were very worried going into season one that they were going to make every single thing with regards to the Stamets and Culber marriage like a very special episode of Star Trek.
Sure, yeah.
And they did the smartest thing possible. It was just presented in a very normalized way. And they're doing this again here with Reno and Culber. I just think it seemed like one of the most like human moments that we got throughout this entire episode, regardless of how we do have some issues with regards to this marriage, you know, story that we've been kind of following dispassionately throughout the course of this season. I don't know. What do you guys think about this? At least how it works as a character moment.
I mean, I really liked Tig Notaro having this monologue. Like, I thought it was great, her talking about the relationship and how important it is, but also about how her and Culber having the scene comparing, like, you know, high maintenance marriage demands or wedding demands.
And multi-denominational shuttle parking.
But like, that is rapid fire, back and forth, funny dialogue.
Yeah.
And like, that's something Star Trek's not known for. And it was seamless. It was never like, oh, this is awkward, they're trying to do comedy. It felt very natural, and it felt natural to the characters.
It wasn't like an Odo Sisko scene, for example. Yeah.
We're always going back and forth, like, what is Discovery? How is it differentiating itself from the other series? It's moments like this that I think it does very well that the other Star Trek shows never would have even tried. And we didn't have Tilly in this episode at all.
Yeah, that was
but
kind of
she
weird.
Also contributes that kind of energy and dialogue as well. So I kind of like that they're going that route because it wasn't just like a fun comedy moment. It was character building as well.
I just like the fact, and Barry, I don't know how you feel about this, but Discovery has like a penchant for the character stuff in that it almost feels as if you can drop in like these superhuman characters with their own flaws, but relate to them in a very human way that it seemed as if a lot of the other Star Trek characters we know from the other series, they seem aloof to a certain degree that I don't necessarily always feel with the Discovery characters. I find them relatable in a way where it's just like dropping regular folks from the 21st century onto kind of a starship setting and let them interact and discuss, I guess, like human things the way that we would in normal life. What do you think of the character stuff that I think Cam and I, we both agree it's kind of one of Discovery's strengths, but I don't know if that translates to all viewers.
I agree with you. It's something I don't think I noticed right away, but definitely have noticed in this season. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in this episode, we had the minor characters at lunch, you know, playing the word game.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is lunch at our office, right, Barry?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Who's the Linus?
And, you know, it didn't feel forced.
Right.
I can't imagine the Next Generation a cast or
can
the
you
characters.
Imagine that scene?
No, not at all.
Worf.
Oh my god.
Yes.
Yeah.
They would make a big deal of it. I mean, yeah. The warmest moments on Next Generation were the poker game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that felt natural. But
sure.
But it was much more a formal setting.
It had more of a theatrical sense to the dialogue. I always think too, Tyler, you and I did that awkward moments episode, and you played that clip of them having breakfast and Geordi asking about the eggs.
Yes.
And it's so awkward and weird. And like, that's the sort of thing you would get of them playing casual dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Put a link up to that awkward moment episode, because that's still one of my favorites.
Yeah, that'll be
to.
In the blog, of course. Yeah.
So, okay. So look, a lot of stuff working for me in this episode. I'm just wondering, as we wrap up here,
we should
really
get into Burnham, though, and Spock's little journey to the Section 31 ship.
Yeah, you know, okay, so that's very much story-based versus kind of the character stuff that we've been leaning into. How this furthers the Red Angel, Red Signal storyline, and ultimately the Section 31 plotline, which Cam, you and I have been a little meh on.
Yeah, how have you felt about it, Barry?
The Red Angel?
Yeah, the Red Angel mystery. And
I think it's lost something with them discovering more and more about what the Red Angel is. And I mean, there's always a problem with time travel. Star Trek loves time travel, and they break all the laws of physics. And time travel always brings with it massive paradoxes they just skip right by.
Yeah.
But that's okay. It's a fictional universe, it's storytelling, and that's cool. So having something from the future, you know, automatically is problematic. But when the Red Angel first started appearing, it was this mystery. And if you remember, early in the season, there was a kind of associated religious mysticism about it.
Yeah.
Which I think has been lost in favor of this kind of trying to wrap your head around time travel stuff.
Yeah.
And they're still trying to, you know, tie this to the fate of the universe. But, you know, the universe doesn't seem to be in jeopardy at the moment. That seems to be the thing that's missing.
They keep, like, claiming it is all sentient life, and we're like, Okay.
Yeah.
If you say so.
They did the same thing in season one with the Spore Drive as well when they were in the Mirror Universe.
Like, it's the fate of the entire existence.
But there was never a sense that was actually happening. Usually you got to show, you know, beams of light being shot across the galaxy where you're like, oh, something seems to be happening. Yeah. That never seems to be the case on the show.
Do any of you guys actually believe that all sentient life will cease to exist by the end of season two?
Yes.
Okay. I do. Yeah. So there is still a lot of tension for you, Cam.
Tons.
Yeah. That's just it. If you kind of raise the stakes that high,
yeah.
Well, you know that that's not actually going to come to fruition. So it you know, saps some of the tension away from the ongoing storyline.
Yeah.
I thought the stuff that they're doing in New Eden, the episode that you were alluding to earlier, Barry, with regards to kind of the religious stuff, I thought that was like one of the big highlights of season two so far. It happened in like episode two.
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, it seemed like such a quintessential Star Trek story that they're trying to tell there. And that was hitting so many more intriguing stuff than I think some of the more time travel-y, you know, pseudoscience Red Angel stuff that they've been hitting on. I'm just kind of like, and too often I think Discovery falls into the tell, don't show trap, which I think they need to kind of lean away from. Cam, with regards to Section 31 stuff, the Comron Gant stuff, did that particular storyline really work for you? Or
it's fine. It's just continuing this search for control, which I think was, in retrospect, a very bad word to use for your evil AI.
It makes me think of Get Smart. I have
obviously Get Smart, but not only that, but there are scenes where Spock's being like, you know, control is broken loose. I've gotten control of the ship. And you're like, wait, what? Like, it's just like,
I had that same thought. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that was a bad idea. Like, it just, these two things are not, and there was a computer screen saying control. And I'm like, is that the AI or does that mean what he's trying to do on the computer?
No, it's a reference to Riker's joystick. Yeah. That's how you control the ship.
But I mean, this stuff was just planting seeds for where we're going with the AI, because obviously Leland's off screen for this episode.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, we had some cool visuals with all the bodies floating in space. The thing I thought was maybe the most interesting, though, and I would like to hear what you guys have to say about it. There was a lot of theories, you know, last week that we're getting maybe a Borg story. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of debate where I think we were kind of coming down more. It's like they want to kind of do a Borg story without using the Borg. And they were showing a lot of, you know, little touchstones. You could say, hey, that's just kind of like the Borg. I don't know if that's the case. It may actually be the Borg. But in this episode, we have Gant show up. And I was convinced this was the Borg because his voice started going like the full-on Borg.
Randomly?
Like, yeah.
He had normal voice for the entire episode. And
yes.
Then it got all like sort of Pro Tools Kanye on stage.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Barry,
are you up for an exploration of the Borg on Star Trek Discovery, or do you kind of feel that, I don't know, maybe Voyager went to that well one too many times and you don't really need to see the Borg ever again?
No, I like the Borg. I don't think they've always done the Borg well. I think the best Borg was in Next Generation when it was unknown and this faceless menace. You know, talk about the universe being in jeopardy. There was that sense in the Next Generation when they had the Borg episodes. The universe was in jeopardy, or at least the Earth and the Federation was in jeopardy. You had that sense of, you know, increasing doom. This foreboding that we don't have with this Red Angel time travel sort of story here. The Borg are cool. I think they can do that.
I think you just want to see a Borg on screen named Hugh.
I never actually liked Hugh, but...
Culber?
Yeah,
oh my God, what's going to happen?
I'm going to tell his husband that you said that.
What, there was an original Hugh, though.
Borg. I thought that was actually a really good episode, though.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, no, I'll give you that. Okay. So, I think they can bring it back. But
did this feel like the Borg to you? Because, like, you have the voice, but then on the flip side, you have, like, nanoprobe tendrils. And I'm like, that doesn't seem very Borg-like to me.
I think the producers really want us
to think it's the Borg,
but it's not.
Sure.
Like, I just think that they're trolling us to a certain degree.
Is it like a proto-Borg idea of like, this could be the future of where the meshing of AI and flesh goes, but this is just a separate thing?
I'm more intrigued by that idea than being a very explicit reference to the Borg. I'm more intrigued by the idea of, you know, like the singularity, for example, which is kind of, as you say, the meshing of our human existence with technology. And we've touched on that with, say, Detmer, for example, with Arium as well. So I think it's ripe for the picking.
In some ways with Pike. with his future.
Ripe for the piking.
Ripe for the piking, yeah.
Yeah, so I just think that they should go with their own sort of storyline instead of going back to that Borg well. Because
we've already gotten so much Star Trek canon within Discovery Season 2. You've got Spock, you've got Pike, you've got Talosians, all that. Do you really need to throw in the Borg as well?
Yeah.
Then they've got to change it because it's too much like the Borg. I mean, if they're trolling the fans, really, a show should not be trolling its fans. You can tease them, you can misdirect them in a good way, but you shouldn't just say, oh, it's kind of the Borg, but not, and you guys will never know until, like, season 5 or something.
Sure.
I mean, that's disrespectful to the fans.
I'm 100% behind you, Arthur. I just think it's... because I think we debated a lot about, say, the ultimate fate of the short Trek Calypso, and whether or not that would be resolved by the end of season 2, or if that's something that they're going to be dragging out throughout the course of the series. And I was very adamant that I think this is something that has to be resolved by the end of season 2. And I think...
they got time crystals. Something's going to happen.
We're getting way more hints that this Calypso short trek is going to be explained by the time we get to the end of this season. So
yeah.
I'm down with that.
Yeah.
But guys, is it weird that we're only 2 episodes away
from the conclusion of
the season? It seems like as if it's kind of blown by. But I wonder how they wrap up all the storylines. If this is where we are right now, at the end of season 2, I wonder if it's going to feel like a very... I don't know, sudden conclusion to this storyline, very much like I thought the end of the Klingon War seemed very, very abrupt at the end of season 1.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
No. So I don't know. Are you guys ready for the show to be done in 2 episodes? Do you think that they've given themselves enough runway to resolve things in a satisfying manner, Barry?
No.
Okay.
I think they need like at least 5 episodes. They've got so many threads.
Yeah.
So many parallel storylines. And that's actually, I think, been one of the weaknesses as well of Discovery, is they're trying to do too much, especially per episode. You look at this episode, you've got 4 different storylines.
Right.
Yes.
And the classic... Trek, the original series, you had one storyline. You focused on that, and then occasional throwback to the ship.
Sometimes that was a bit of a stretch, though.
Yeah, yeah. And then TNG, you had your main storyline, and then you had a secondary one, an A and a B.
Yeah.
Right.
And you had that rhythm back and forth between the major and the minor. And this one, you've got A, B, C, D, E.
Mm-hmm.
Were you
listing off all your favorite Enterprises?
Yes, exactly. and it was kind of hard to figure out, so where is the focus here? And maybe that's, because I'm an older generation, we don't multitask. We just focus on one thing only. So get rid of all these other things. You're confusing me, you kids.
I mean, I complain about the same thing. Original series is my favorite show, and I've complained. I just want whole episodes where characters are in shuttle pods talking to one another.
Yeah. That's what made the original series pop.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The characters.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it wraps up. I have to believe it's going to be more satisfying than how the Klingon War wrapped up.
Yeah.
I just don't. I think they learned the lesson.
I think that's a low point for the series.
And I think ultimately, like, resolving Leland and the runaway AI ship is a lot easier to resolve in an episode than a Klingon War, which has all these complications tied around it.
Yeah. I mean, I think self-destruct mode, boom.
Yeah.
Section 31 ships. Destroyed.
Is it just going to come down to a big ship-based action sequence?
I hope not, because those are kind of, unless they're done in a very unique, super exciting way, I don't know if there's anything different that they can offer us, unless it's very much a character-based action sequence, but those are kind of tough to pull off with, ship-to-ship combat.
Yeah.
I don't know, it'd be cool if, I don't know, the Section 31 ship is programmed to fly into the sun. That would be interesting to look at. I don't know.
One thing I hope they kind of deal with, because I'm finding it a bit torturous, is this Ash Tyler Burnham romantic relationship.
I don't care.
It's
at
so
all.
Cheesy.
At
because,
all.
Like, in this one, Laurel's saying, I know you'll always love Burnham. And we see the two of them together, and she finds out he has a son, which was one of my laugh out loud moments, was just like Burnham's like reaction.
She has to sit down. She literally has to sit down.
There was 2 great funny moments involving relationships. One was that. The other was Laurel and Ash Tyler yelling at each other, and Pike standing there awkwardly. But, they're giving us this real sense of, like, this is a romance of the ages. Like, these are 2 souls tethered together. And I'm like, how long did they date?
I think we determined the math. It was, like, 3 or 4 weeks.
It was not long.
I think it was, what we determined is, like, after week 2, they were telling each other that they loved each other.
Yeah.
And we were like, 2 weeks of dating?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then they're, like, hurled into the mirror universe. And then they're kind of busy.
Yeah.
They got other things going on.
So I don't know. And the other problem is, these actors, they have chemistry with so many other actors on the series. these two particular actors don't have chemistry with each other, and they keep really forcing this. And I just don't think anyone's out there buying it. There's so much, like, I don't know, fan art of Hugh and Paul. Mm-hmm. There's no one making fan art of Ash Tyler and Michael Burnham.
Other than you.
Well, yeah, obviously. So they're beautiful stick figures if anybody wants to see them.
But I want to see some sort of resolution to this. I just don't. I really don't want to see.
Okay, if they just drop it and never reference
drop
it ever again.
In some way. Just give us some sort of something. Yeah. I assume we're going to get back to normalcy in season three with Culber and Stamets, where they're a couple and maybe one of those characters has a drama and then the other one's involved in it. And that's interesting. We can get drama out of that aspect of the relationship as opposed to the two of them being split apart. But I do not need Burnham and Ash Tyler coming together, then being forced apart, and then being pulled together by the strands of fate. You know, it's like there's other people out there.
The writers must realize no one cares or no one's interested.
I loved how easily Burnham took to, like, she had to sit down, but then she's like, well, okay, I can deal with this. I'm like, wow, try online dating. Man, it's a lot harder than this.
Well, it's kind of the least difficult thing she's had to deal with him.
That is true.
Like, he's killed, one of her colleagues, and he's like he's a half Klingon and all this kind of stuff. I mean, having a son that she didn't know about, okay, yeah, that's
he's
that's
just
a human
full of
thing.
Surprises. She should be running away from this man.
How
she,
many red flags does this woman need? And does it's ridiculous.
This is a toxic relationship to be in. Like, there's just nothing but like torturous surprises in store for her.
Is there,
stay away.
Is there any relationship in Star Trek that is similarly fraught with like ridiculous drama?
With ridiculous drama.
I mean, it doesn't have to be as absurd, but just in the sense of like constant roadblocks being thrown between these two characters we keep being convinced belong together.
Yes, Kes and Neelix.
But even that, they broke up pretty quick.
Yeah,
it was like a couple seasons in.
But I think they probably had more episodes accumulatively as a couple than we've ever had altogether with Ash and Burnham.
Yeah.
So.
But I can
jealous
accept.
Neelix was the worst.
It was the worst.
It was
just,
it was like. Super toxic masculinity all over the place. Like, even as a 12-year-old, I could recognize that at the time.
It was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, I can accept dramatic complications in a relationship that unfold over seven seasons, but this is over like 1 year of Discovery.
I know
what I mean? Like, Ash Tyler's not in that many episodes. It's like every episode he's in, it's like, by the way, Burnham, I have something else to confess. So,
well, Barry just passed me a note. It says Ash Tyler's my favorite character.
No, not my
better
favorite
take it all
character.
Back.
Yeah, you see the NOT there in giant capital letters, underscored.
I missed that. I didn't completely unfold the note.
I don't mind the character. I don't mind the. I like the actor. And is he? You guys might know more. Is he going to the spinoff?
Don't know.
Show?
Haven't heard anything. My suspicion is he's around for season three on Discovery, and I think the earliest the spinoff would ever happen would be concurrently with season four of Discovery for the Section 31.
Oh, so it's still that far away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to the Picard spinoff coming this fall, though, Barry?
Yes, I am.
You're down to watch that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We can get you to guest on that future episode?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I would like to know, though, just as we wrap up, Barry, you know, where do you hope that the finale of season two with Discovery goes? Like, what would you like to see to kind of set the table for season three?
Ash Tyler and Burnham reconciling.
Over candlelight.
or switching with Hugh and Stamets, you know, like mixing it up. Because what was the lesson from a couple of episodes ago? You know, don't think binary. Like, come on, people, mix it up a little here.
As a very fascinating scene to watch, Giorgio.
And then an example of a scene that we could not have imagined in previous incarnations.
Well,
of
we could
Trek.
Have imagined it, but it wasn't a reality.
Yeah. I don't think 1960s Jim Kirk is having that conversation aboard his ship at that time.
No.
I don't know what I hope for, but I actually believe that there'll be a cliffhanger. I think that they're going to be looking maybe to season two of TNG, and I'm saying that because that's my favorite series, as kind of a model and some kind of cliffhanger. They're not going to resolve the Red Angel. They're not going to resolve the everyone in the universe is going to die thing. I think they're going, something's going to happen to at least two of the characters.
Right.
Maybe we'll think they have died, or maybe they'll die, or they'll be taken over by control or something, and then we'll have a cliffhanger. They need something to bring characters back, and as we've identified, there's no way that they can wrap all these plot lines up this season. So I think a lot of things are going to be left unresolved on the table. And as a fan and as a storyteller, that's what I would want too. I'm very fine with uncertainty. Uncertainty will bring me back for season three. So I don't want any resolution.
Awesome. I think, it's going to be really interesting to see, and we don't have to wait long to find out.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Next week, we'll be back with episode 13 of the second season of Star Trek Discovery. Getting right to the end here, the penultimate episode. I'm very intrigued to see where this goes. Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Veil of the Present Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's Reporton. N as in name rhymes with poo.
And Barry, are you on Twitter?
I'm a Blink Writer.
Okay.
Yeah, see, Barry, if you're a big fan of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, I think your Twitter name would be The Great Link.
If I was a fan of Deep Space
Nine. DS9 was your favorite series, like your Twitter handle would have to be The Great Link or Barry The Great Link.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not because... not a great fan. I didn't mind that one, but not a great fan.
Okay.
But yeah, you can find me at Blink Writer.
Awesome. Okay.
As in Enterprise B.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Captain Harriman. Okay, so on that note, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.